Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 1 for Autumn Semester 2016. Lecture 14, delivered on October 6, 2016. The title of this lecture is Types of Bonds.
Today, types of bonds. Now, I went through the basics of bond price dynamics with you in the last lecture. It's really not too hard. I would strongly recommend that you use the calculator, the financial calculator in the online resources to get your bond prices and your bond yields and all of that, because the formulas in general are very tough to get to work exactly right. Small mistakes and little putting the parenthesis in the wrong place can get you the wrong answer. But at the same time, the pricing is not all that difficult on bonds. However, there are lots of different types of debt instruments out there. Generically, we use that term bond. I brought up a couple in the last lecture. Corporate and government debt securities is one way to categorize. Investment grade versus speculative or junk, that's another way to go about categorizing debt instruments. But in general, first, I think I brought this up early in the course. The bond market is a quiet market. It's not a sexy market. It's not what you're going to hear about, think about when you think about investments. But it is 10 times the size of the equities market. It is a massive, massive market. Part of that's because bonds generally tend to be safer than stocks, and so they are a high-grade way to invest without a lot of risk. Another thing is, of course, as I had brought up before, equity is a much more expensive source of capital for a company than debt is. Debt is actually relatively cheap, at least in general, compared to equity. Whereas the component cost of capital for equity might be 20%. In other words, it costs a company 20% to have shareholders. It costs the company more to have new shareholders. Debt is, after taxes, especially after the company deducts the interest expense, which it can, and it can't do that for dividends, debt can be like 4%, 6%. So there you go. It gives you an idea of why the debt market is so huge. An interesting take on this, I have professionals, industry professionals, come in to talk to my finance students all the time in the finance club, and I'll be doing that with the economics club now. But one of them, a country financial wealth management professional, said, look, imagine like, 20 years ago, I could have had a couple come in and they have $1 million to put in to an account, and they want to just get a check for a check every year. Essentially, they want a safe investment, a very safe investment. They don't want any risk or a lot of risk. She said, 20 years ago, I could have gotten them on $1 million. I could have probably gotten them eight easily, without a sweat, investing in debt instruments. I could have gotten them $80,000 a year for the rest of their lives. And at very low risk with high quality debt, bonds, investing. She said, now, I probably couldn't, having low risk, the same kind of risk, these days I probably couldn't guarantee them $30,000 a year on a similar risk investments. because bond prices, bond yields, bond coupons are so low anymore. They're ridiculously low historically. And so as an investment for retirement, they just don't have that punch that they used to have. And that produces a challenge in wealth management because we want these people to have safe investments. We don't want to put their money at risk in their retirement years. But at the same time, we don't want them to have $1 million and all that does is get them 30 grand a year to work, to live on. Not a good situation right now in the bond market that way. But the other thing is, as I had just said, bonds are not volatile the way stocks are. Bonds are not something that you invest in to get big capital gains. Because at the end of the day, if the bond is going to retire, if the company is sound, the bond's going to go to $1,000 as it approaches maturity. Remember I told you that the last time. And I also mentioned that that's a great question for an exam, something about bond price dynamics as with respect to time and all that. Okay, what else is there that I could do and talk about bonds? Well, one way to talk about bonds is to talk about them in terms of seniority of obligation. So, in other words, you decide that you're going to borrow money for the first time as a corporation. You would be issuing senior debt. Okay? Now, there would be two flavors of it. There would be collateralized senior debt, which we generally refer to as mortgage bonds. And there is also unsecured debt, which we generally refer to as debentures. Debentures. And, of course, the debentures would have a higher risk and, therefore, a higher coupon. Because in liquidation, a mortgage bond would be able to point to specific assets. These belong to us. Liquidate them and give us the money. Whereas the debentures, they would essentially get whatever was left over after mortgage bonds had been satisfied with their associated assets. But then you can have senior subordinated. In other words, the seniors would get paid first once they were covered in a bankruptcy, and this is only in bankruptcy, then the senior subordinated would be paid off. Generally, a little bit more risk with these, so the coupon's going to be a little higher. But then you can have junior. These are below the senior and the senior subordinated. And then you can have the junior subordinated. By the time you get down to this level, you're beginning to see the coupon a little more serious. So if you're looking for a little bit better yield or a little bit better check every year, well, you would probably look to these kinds of animals, but recognize the fact that if the company goes tap city, well, these are going to be paid off, and then if there's any left over, then the juniors and the junior subordinates. And then below those, other kinds of debt are going to get theirs, like bills that are owed by the company. They wouldn't get anything until all of this had been paid off. An interesting story in this regard, and I'll let you decide whether this is right or not right. A company went into bankruptcy. This has been 20 years ago. It established a precedent in the bankruptcy court proceedings. The company went into bankruptcy. Okay. Well, the lawyers for the debt holders swooped in and started gobbling up the assets and all of that, liquidating, getting everything liquidated to get their money. Well, this was a retail company that did catalog sales. And so they had a lot of orders for merchandise, and those orders were in a warehouse ready to be shipped when the company went into bankruptcy. So there was all these things that these customers had ordered, paid for, and everything. So they were clearly debt holders of the corporation. the corporation owed them their merchandise. Now, the question was, first of all, who was going to represent these debt holders, and where did they sit in the priority of claims of the debt holders? Were they high claimants? Because obviously they were short-term debt holders. They paid cash money. The merchandise, they could say, this belongs to me. I paid for this thing that's sitting in the warehouse. So it was clearly a collateralized kind of obligation. But what would the bankruptcy court do? When you have all these powerful lawyers for these powerful interests that had invested in the senior subordinated, junior subordinated debt instruments, what was the court going to do as far as priority of claim for these just regular customers like you and me who had these orders that were not shipped? Well, the court said they are the lowest of the low, and the liquidate everything and pay money to all of these high debt holders, the institutional investors. By the time you get down to the low lives like these cats, these customers who put in orders, there was nothing for them at all. They didn't get their merchandise. They didn't get a dime. Many of them were not even informed that there had been a bankruptcy. They had to find out through newspaper articles or trying to call the company to find out where their orders were because they didn't have any lawyers representing their interests. So they were basically sold out by the power of the debt holders at the top end of the chain. Make your own decision about whether or not that was right in a fairness sort of sense, or even in a legal sense, when you got collateralized obligations that weren't even considered. A lot of this stuff that the corporation owed was debentures. There was no collateralization whatsoever, but they got theirs first before these collateralized customers got anything, and they ended up with zero in this bankruptcy. So there's a lesson for you right there that you better have, if you're going to be a debt holder, make sure that you're one of these heavy duties who have lawyers behind you to go to the court and get your claims made. Anyway, there are other kinds of debt out there, other kinds of debt. And there's some stories here that are kind of disturbing in a way. One arena of debt, and I mentioned it a little bit, municipal bonds, what we call munis. Now, these are all kinds of things. You, madam, run a city, and you need a new sewer system. Well, you're going to probably go to the voters and say, will you please approve a bond issue? And the voters, if they say yes, a certain amount of their taxes will be bumped up, property taxes probably, and that will be dedicated to paying the coupons and the retirement of a bond that will be used to raise the funds to upgrade the sewer system of the city. That would be a classic municipal bond, very simple, straightforward. But there are all kinds of other municipal bonds out there. I mean, you can have them states technically can be called municipals, munis. I mean, you can have them for school districts. If I want to build a new high school, okay, well, what I'm going to do is go to the voters. Voters, please approve a bond issue. And if the voters say yes, their taxes will be increased and the property taxes will be, and that property tax increase will guarantee payments on a bond that will be sold into the bond market as a primary issue. There are investment bankers, all they do is make the arrangements to place this kind of debt. That's what they do. I had one. I really didn't even know how well integrated this market was until about 4 years ago. I had a guy come in and talk. He was one of the people who makes the arrangements with school districts for their bond issues. He works with the investment bankers in the heavy-duty cities, And they buy the bonds, and then they sell it to their investors. But everything is set up for these school districts to get their money to build their schools. They get the money up front, and then they pay the coupons, and then retire the debt at the end. Simple, like a corporation would do it, except for the revenue to pay for the bond comes from the tax-paying public. Therein lies a problem that has been big over the years. When a school district goes to the voters and says, voters, please approve this school this levy for some new schools for us, or for up improving our schools, there is a major problem with voters saying, no, we don't want to. And there are all kinds of excuses. Well, the teachers suck. The schools are bad. My kid doesn't need any better than I had. All kinds of things. And the bottom line is, we just don't want to pay more money for better schools. That's why there are a lot of states that are struggling to find other ways to fund, especially when you have poor school districts that are much less likely to get school levies passed than rich school districts. And if they do get them passed, rich school districts can afford much larger bond packages and therefore much nicer schools. But also the other problem is that you've got a lot of voters who just, they don't have kids, so they're not going to vote for these. And or they are property holders, and they will generally tend to vote against them. And the non-property holders generally tend to vote in these kinds of elections for school levies. Municipals. Here's the kicker. If you look at the coupon on a municipal, it is much lower than the coupon on a corporate bond. Why? Because the interest that you as an investor would get on a municipal is tax exempt. You don't have to pay state tax on it, okay? You don't have to pay certain taxes. Depends on what it is. So in other words, the coupons on these will reflect the fact that it's tax-free. But a corporate bond, you get the coupon on that, you pay tax on it. So the corporate bond's coupon will have to be higher than a muni's coupon will. You follow it? So muni's will have lower taxes. So in other words, a corporate bond would have to have something like 8%. But the equivalent municipal bond wouldn't have to have nearly as high a percent, because this 8%, what you would get after taxes on that one would be 8% times 1 minus your marginal tax rate. Now, here's the thing, though. That means that municipal bonds are not going to be bought by people like you. You should never, ever buy a municipal bond, because their coupons are priced at for high tax rate investors. So in other words, the corporate bond here, let's say you have a tax rate of 40%, 6 times 1 minus 0.4, that's 0.6, 4.8%. So the muni equivalent has to hit about 4.8% to compete with the corporate bond. But if you're a lower tax investor, lower tax rate, then this muni is going to pay you lower than you would get. Like if you're in a 20% tax bracket, then this 8% bond is going to pay you 6.4%. So getting 4.8% on a muni is not in your interest. As a lower income investor with lower tax rate, you should never buy munis. You should never invest in them, because they are a rich investors' investment vehicle. Okay, so just keep that in mind, that munis are not your, you shouldn't do these. But here's the nasty part. Remember what I was telling you about the Federal Reserve and its open market operations and all the banks and how they have to have a certain amount of highly liquid securities? Okay, that tier one stuff. Tier one in a bank is cash, treasury bills, and historically very, very high quality paper from government agencies, what's called agency debt. Now, one thing that has been historically part of a bank's portfolio as far as Tier 1 capital goes was munis. Banks could invest in munis. As a matter of fact, banks historically just bought up school levy bonds. They would buy up the bonds for new sewer systems, new water systems. They would do that. That was part of what they did because for them, it would go into their Tier 1 capital. It was safe investments, and everyone... It worked for everyone. The market schools knew that they had investors for their bonds that they issued and all that kind of stuff. Well, the Federal Reserve last year passed a new regulation that banks could no longer count munis in their Tier 1 capital. No longer. You can't do it anymore. So essentially, the primary capital source for municipal securities, including schools issuing bonds, just vanished overnight at the beginning of this year. Just vanished. Just went away. Gone. Because the banks can't use them in their Tier 1. Why are the banks going to buy them? Banks are just going to say, screw that. And, of course, the larger markets, they've got all kinds of other things. They've got tons of things they have to buy bonds for. And munis, they'll buy munis, sure, but, I mean, they've got corporate debt, other government agency debt they have to buy. The schools, cities that need new water systems, states that need new bridge repairs, I mean, it's gone. The primary way that had historically been there for investment in our infrastructure of our nation, gone, thanks to the Federal Reserve making this new rule. Now, why did they make the rule? Well, the short answer is they were just interested in banks having high-quality debt, high-quality securities in their Tier 1 capital. The long answer is that it was pressure from other demanders of debt capital who wanted to get rid of one of their competitors, that is the schools and the cities and the states. Okay, now, municipals. Quick note on municipals. There have been some spectacular defaults on munis. I mean, spectacular. One from before your time that really shook us up, because I think it was like one of the first times in anyone's memory that a muni had defaulted was in Cleveland. Cleveland just went bankrupt under the administration. I cannot remember that idiot's name, but he became the mayor, and he drove the city into just absolute financial apocalypse, and Cleveland just defaulted on munis. It shook the muni market up really seriously. And all munis, interestingly enough, when one muni defaults, all muni coupons have to go up to get investors to feel safe again. I mean, it was just unbelievable. Munis that were already out there just dropped in price because the yields on them, the market started driving yields up on them. So the prices of munis that were already out there in the market went through the floor. New munis that were issued had to have coupons that were considerably higher than they had been before because suddenly investors saw that there really was risk in them. Okay, now, in your time, does anyone know of any munis that have defaulted in your time, in the last few years maybe? Yeah? Detroit. You got it. There you go. Detroit. Detroit went Tap City on, and so... Of course, there you go again. So the Federal Reserve is saying, see, munis, they can... No, you moron. We're talking about munis like cities that should die. But maybe we shouldn't have banks investing in those. But that doesn't mean banks shouldn't be investing in school bonds, for sure. But there are other munis that are... There are other munis that are in trouble too. For example, let's talk about Illinois. Illinois there's a famous term in investment, the Illinois premium. The Illinois premium, any muni that comes out of any hole in Illinois is going to have a bump of 25 to 50 basis points on the coupon. It has to. The investors are going to say, oh, that's Illinois. Nope. And so, essentially, Illinois sets the standard. It is not the only state, though. We've got the reputation, but I mean, there are other states that have the premium as well. Some in recent years have started showing. Of course, California has had a premium. I mean, my God, California had a premium when the Native Americans still owned the plot of the place. It's been in troubles for so long with all of its expenditures. But and also, California passed something many, many years ago, a proposition that essentially limited the ability of the state to raise money from taxes in the state of California. And that proposition is still on the books, and it has essentially crippled the state's ability to raise money for a long, long time. Hence why California is constantly in such serious deficits and in serious trouble. Other states that have problems right now, interestingly enough, Wisconsin is a serious concern in municipal markets because of the expenditures that have been propelled by the current governor at the same time that you have other bizarre things, workforce demoralization, the public sector is in such dire straits, especially the teachers, the schools, really a big mess down there. Other states have a problem with their munis too. So it's not just Illinois. Illinois is just the poster child for irresponsibility. And that trickles down to the level of schools where we really shouldn't, and infrastructure like bridges and roads where we really shouldn't be playing around with funding sources. Okay, now, other kinds of bonds. You can invest, and I strongly recommend that you watch yourself. And this is a very risky game. You can invest in foreign bonds. You can invest in companies overseas or in nations overseas in their debt instruments. You get, I could invest in German government bonds. The danger, the big danger, is not that these are going to go tap city. I mean, a lot of these countries, they're strong. I mean, Germany is a very strong country. The danger is in the currency swings between the dollar and the Deutschmark. So, for example, or the euro, I should say. So, for example, if I invest in a bond, let's say a European bond, now I will be paid my coupons and my payoff in euros, okay? So if the euro swings against the dollar, my dollar value of my European payments will change as well. And that could be rather adverse because what could happen is that I might be expecting, let's say, a euro to a dollar. Let's say $1 USD 1 is... at that level of trading right now, okay? So what I would do is I might be expecting $1,000. I might be expecting 1,000 euros. 1,000 euros at the end. Okay, 1,000 euros times USD 1 over... Euro 1.25. That's what I might be expecting, okay? And I'll do that on the calculator here very quickly, if I can. And I don't trust myself to do this. So I'll do 1,000 divided by 1.25. So that'd be, my expectation would be to get USD 800 on the face, okay? That would be my expectation. But now let's say that sometime over the life of this European bond, this foreign bond, the USD 1 goes to, let's say, 75 against the euro. In this case, I would then have a $1,000 face times USD 1 over Euro 0.75. Well, this is going to work out really well for us, okay? 1,000 divided by 0.75. So in this case, I'm going to get USD 1,333.33. Worked for me that time, didn't it? Well, let's see what happens if things go the other way. Suppose that the USD 1 goes to the euro at 150. In this case, my payoff would then be euro 1,000 times USD 1 over euro 150. And in this case, I end up with really 1 over 1.5, 1,000 divided by 1.5 equals, ouch. Currency rate risk becomes part of the equation. Currency rate risk becomes part of your equation investing in foreign bonds. And that is, of course, something that can, you might like that kind of risk. That might be something you want. You might even be betting on the dollar going this way, the dollar strengthening against the euro. I mean, it's your call, but know that if you're going to do that, it could go against you, and you could take a butt bath on a foreign bond. Now, there are actually reasons why you might do this and not want, you're not a speculator. If you're doing this raw, if you're doing these naked, then you are a currency speculator. That's what you are. As a matter of fact, that would have been the George Soros game in when he destroyed the Bank of London and wrecked the British economy. He was speculating on debt and currency movements. That's what he was doing. He was borrowing pounds, sterling, and then using that to buy Deutschmarks. And then when the pound sterling collapsed, he converted the Deutschmarks back into pound sterling and paid off his debts that were in pound sterling and pocketed the difference, making over way over a billion dollars, his Quantum Group did. So if you're into that, that's cool. But there are actually reasons why you might be buying these not being a speculator. You might actually buy these as hedge instruments. But anyway, I'll get into that later, hedging with this kind of stuff. That comes a little later. Now, one last thing I should bring up here, and I'd already mentioned it before, but I want to make sure that you know about, you've heard of this. It's called agency debt. And honestly, I don't know how many of you are going to get into finance, how many of you would get into institutional finance, or how many of you would get into banking or run into or work in government in some capacity. But when we think of government debt, we think of treasury, treasury bills, treasury notes, treasury bonds. These dollar bills that I've shown you in class, they're a treasury debt, basically. However, there are other kinds of government debt that are off the books of what you see when you see the national debt or the deficit for the year. Agencies of the United States government can issue their own debt. It is not backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government. But historically, there's been the assumption that if any of these agencies ever defaulted, of course the government would pay the bill. But there's no statement in law that the federal government has to pay agency debt. Now, what do I mean by agency debt? I mean, for example, there are a lot of authorities in the United States that are federally chartered, like the Tennessee Valley Authority, the TVA. It issues its own government debt. Its own agency debt. There are many agencies that they borrow their own money. It's not part of the national deficit, but it's out there. And it's very attractive. Institutional investors buy it all the time. And how much is it? Well, interestingly enough, I mean, this debt has actually gone up and up over the last, 30, 40 years. I mean, these agencies borrowing for their own accounts and not going to the government to get money, it's just what they do. And then from the revenues that they get, they pay their coupons and they retire their debts like anyone else does. But it's out there, agency debt is. It's considered safe, but like I said, just keep in mind, there is no law that says the government has to honor that debt. So if, like the Tennessee Valley Authority, the TVA, or some of these other hydroelectric projects and all of that, if they ever went Tap City, the United States government really doesn't have to bother to pay them off. The same is true with these massive animals, these beasts called in the secondary mortgage market, Ginny Mae, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. What they do is they buy giant packages of loans, like home loans, farm loans, student loans, and they ball them into these big, huge packages, but then sometimes they just carve them up. Okay, we're going to have a super bond that is nothing but the payments on home loans. And then over here, we'll have another super bond that is the payoffs of loans. And then we'll have another super bond over here that might be the payoffs that are earlier than expected on loans. So they carve these up into hundreds of millions, billions of dollar giant super bonds, and then they sell these. Who buys them? Foreign governments that have massive amounts of American currency that they have gotten because we bought their stuff, their exports. Like China. China buys tons of this paper that is out there in the secondary mortgage market. However, this is not guaranteed. It is essentially these things like Ginny Mae, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, they are authorized by the United States government, but they don't answer to anybody. They don't answer to anybody. And that debt, those giant Ginny Mae's, those giant Freddie Mac's, those bonds are not backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government. So if they ever went Tap City, which they got in trouble, some of them did, because they had a lot of high-risk loans in the early 2000s, there's no guarantee that they would pay off. And if one of those went default, it would be an apocalypse, because those things are so huge, those bond packages, those bond issues are. Last thing, I do want to bring up one little thing. I think I mentioned it before. I'm pretty sure I did. But you borrow a lot of money, okay? You want to borrow $100 million. So I could arrange it, let's say, on a 6% coupon. So $100 million at a 6% coupon, you've got to pay $6 million a year. Let's say it's 20 years. The end of 20 years, you have to pay back the $100 million. Well, I, as the investor and the covenants, I'm going to make sure that you're putting the money away like a pile of money every year so that you can pay me off my $100 million. So every year for 20 years, actually, it's going to be front-loaded. I'm going to expect you to put in like, oh, I don't know, probably about $8 million, $10 million every year and get it all in a bank account that the trustee watches so that you can't touch it, and it's there for me at the end. You can pay me off. An alternative is out there, and you'll see this. It's somewhat popular. In some industries, it's more popular than others. It's where, what was I thinking? Oh, you issue serial bonds. In other words, instead of issuing $100 million in 1 year, what you will do is issue, let's say, $20 million in the first year, $20 million in the second year, $20 million third year, $20 million fourth, so that over 5 years you raise $100 million. But in any given year, all you owe at the payoff is $20 million. Serial bonds are out there. Last thing about this whole thing. Who invests in bonds? Interestingly enough, investment in bonds is done by, insurance companies have historically been big investors in bonds, big investors, especially life insurance companies, because you, madam, you are going to die, but probably not for a long time. So if I am an insurance company, I would like to collect insurance premiums for you, knowing that I won't need the money to pay off your funeral bill for 20, 30 years. Okay? So that would make a bond an ideal investment for me, because then I don't get the money back for a long, long time. In fact, property, certain types of property insurance, if I'm insuring against earthquakes here in the Midwest, I don't need to worry about an earthquake happening tomorrow. But I do have to worry about a cataclysmic earthquake happening in the next 50 to 100 years. We sit on one of the apocalypse fault lines. And it's, interestingly, I might have already told you this, but there was a guy who came in. He does the insurance, earthquake insurance. And he was showing the probability that they are using for calculating earthquake insurance premiums here in the Midwest. You can see that over the last 10 years, the probability, it's still a very small thing. But like 10 years ago, it was 0.0001% chance in that year of an earthquake. This last one that he, you saw the last year that he had a probability that they were using for calculating earthquake insurance, it had gotten up to 0.02, I think, percent. I mean, that's still very, very low, but it's still a little bit disturbing that every year we don't have an earthquake means that the next year there's a higher, slightly higher probability. As that fault line, it's called the New Madrid fault line, stresses more and more. And I had an insurance guy tell me, he's an actuary, he said, you should see what's going to happen to the premium over the next 10 years, because there are a lot of geologists and geoengineers who say all this insane fracking that's going on is actually increasing the probability of the New Madrid breaking hard in the every year, getting worse and worse because we're not stopping. We don't get it. Those earthquakes in Oklahoma, those earthquakes in Missouri, those were fracking earthquakes, and they are associated. They are stressing the New Madrid fault line. Every time one of those happens, the big fault line stresses more. So you've got an interesting thing happening there. Insurance companies, they buy bonds because they don't think they're going to need that money for years and years and years. But interestingly enough, as the probability of a payoff, a major payout, increases, they buy bonds of shorter and shorter maturities because they will need the payoff sooner and sooner. Now, that should comfort you, you know, because if that line, fault line breaks, well, the Mississippi, the last time, the Mississippi actually was thrown forward, and then it came back as a tsunami backward. But we got all these pipelines, oil pipelines, gas pipelines that crisscross the country. They all come through our state right here. Matter of fact, right through this area right here. So don't worry. You won't suffer. You will be baked very quickly when they break. Okay, other things. The Federal Reserve has started getting, it's always done this, but it's now being more open about buying bonds. As part of its portfolio, it is actually openly saying, well, they buy treasury debt all the time. That's how our government funds its operations, a lot of its operations. If it doesn't have taxes to do it, what it does is it has the Federal Reserve buy the debt from the government, and then the Federal Reserve prints money as the obligation the government has. So this money you have is the Federal Reserve printing the obligations that the government has to the Federal Reserve. Work that out. Okay, who else is? Institutional investors. Trust funds are huge, big, massive, enormous trust funds. Very old, established corporations are heavy investors in debt instruments. These companies that have billions and billions, hundreds of billions of dollars in reserves, a lot of that you'll see old money like that in long-term bonds. They are buyers in the bond market. Very rich families are buyers in the bond market. I mean, that investment bankers know that these are just part of who you sell your bond issues to, are essentially institutional investors, banks, insurance companies, trust funds, rich families around the world. And essentially, we may have our fights with the Chinese, the Russians, you name it. But at the end of the day, business is business. And if you've got a very powerful Russian warlord who's got $150 billion just kicking around, you're going to go to him with a debt issue that you have. Or the Chinese, business is business. We may have all of our fights and all of our arguments with the Iranians, but if they've got money, we'll go to them for a bond issue to raise money or to... Hell, even anymore, some of our biggest sources of funds are drug cartels. Huge, vast oceans of money are flowing in the cartels out of Central and South America. And those go into legitimate instruments to fund operations and to make our system work well. Okay, now I'm going to give you a quiz. It's two questions. And then when you finish the quiz, you're all done for the day.